Think about the last time you woke up from a truly vivid dream.
Oh, yeah. Like the ones where you're absolutely convinced it's real.
Exactly. Maybe you're being chased, or I don't know, maybe you were just standing in a house you didn't recognize. But while you were in it, that reality was absolute, wasn't it?
Totally binary. I mean, while you're in it, the dream is entirely undeniably real to the mind experiencing it.
Right. The ground beneath your dream feet felt solid. If you stubbed your dream toe, it hurt. The danger felt terrifying. The joy felt euphoric.
Your nervous system reacts, your heart beats faster. The illusion is, well, it's perfect.
It is. We take tremendous comfort in that solidity. But then an alarm goes off, your eyes open, and in a fraction of a millisecond, that entire universe just vanishes.
Yeah, the solid ground, the danger, the strangers, all of it.
Gone. You realize that what seemed inherently real was entirely fabricated by your own mind. You step into the waking world, and suddenly the absolute certainty of that dream landscape is revealed to be, well, an illusion.
Right. It didn't exist from its own side. It only existed because your mind was actively producing it.
Exactly. And it is the absolute definition of a perceptual paradigm shift.
It really is. And what we are going to explore today suggests that our waking life, this solid everyday reality you and I are navigating right now.
The chair you're sitting in, the problems you're worrying about.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. That all of it is actually functioning on a very similar, profoundly convincing, but ultimately deceptive level.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are settling in for something incredibly special for you. We are engaging with a profound transmission of established Buddhist wisdom.
It's really quite a journey we have ahead of us.
It is. We're going to explore a masterclass delivered back in 1996 by Geshe Dawa Galtzon at Buddha House in Adelaide, Australia.
Right.
Over the course of 11 incredibly detailed, rigorous teaching sessions, he provided a comprehensive commentary on the Heart Sutra, which is known in Sanskrit as the Prajnaparamita Hridaya.
And just to give you a sense of scale, for those who might not be intimately familiar with the breadth of the Mahayana canon, the Heart Sutra is revered as the condensed, absolute essence of all the Buddha's 84,000 teachings on the perfection of wisdom.
84,000 teachings, that is massive.
It is. It is the absolute pinnacle of Buddhist philosophy regarding the nature of reality. It's very short, actually. It's often chanted in just a few minutes, but it contains the DNA of the entire path to enlightenment.
But our mission for you today isn't just to recite high-level theory
No, definitely not.
or leave you floating in abstract academic philosophy. We are going to systematically walk you through Geshe Dawa's teachings, starting from the broader context of what the perfection of wisdom actually is.
All the way down to the precise, practical, step-by-step instructions. The kind of beginner needs to actually sit on a cushion and meditate on emptiness using logical analysis.
Okay, let's unpack this. What makes this specific 1996 series so incredibly valuable is Geshe Dawa's pedagogical approach.
Oh, absolutely.
As a highly trained master from the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, following the traditional commentary by Panchen Losang Poldan, he takes this impossibly vast literature and just he distills it.
Yeah, and he doesn't dumb it down either.
Not at all. He provides accessible, rigorous instructions that we can actually apply to our own minds.
What's fascinating here is how Geshe Dawa carefully bridges that gap between the profoundly philosophical and the beginner-friendly practice.
It's such a delicate
It
balance.
really is. He emphasizes over and over that understanding what is called the Prasangika Madhyamika view, which is considered the highest, most subtle philosophical tenet system in Buddhism, isn't just an intellectual flex.
Right. It's not for winning debates at a university.
Exactly. It is the essential, non-negotiable tool required to overcome the foundational ignorance that roots us in samsara, the cycle of suffering.
I think before we can even look at what the Heart Sutra actually says, those famous lines like form is empty that everyone knows, we need to understand the precise context of how and why it was taught.
Yes, the setting is crucial.
Geshe Dawa starts his commentary by explaining the four perfect circumstances that open the sutra. And this isn't just like throat clearing. This is establishing the absolute validity of the lineage.
Yeah, so the sutra begins with the traditional phrasing, "Thus have I heard at one time."
Right.
And this phrasing is vital. It immediately establishes the historical and energetic validity of the text. It means this was directly heard by an enlightened disciple. Traditionally, that's Ananda.
And passed down orally.
Exactly. So that pinpoints the right time. Then we have the right teacher, which is the Bhagavan, the Buddha himself.
Okay, time and teacher.
Then we have the right place, which is Rajgir, specifically Vulture Peak Mountain in India. And finally, the Rite Assembly.
And this wasn't just a small group, right?
Oh, no. It consisted of vast great assemblies of bodhisattvas and monks, including the Buddha's 8 close disciples.
But the dynamic of this teaching is so unique. I mean, when I first read the Heart Sutra years ago, I fully expected the Buddha to just start giving a sermon.
That is the standard expectation, yeah.
But he doesn't actually speak the core of the sutra. Geshe Dawa explains that the Buddha is sitting there, absorbed in a deep meditation, a concentration called profound illumination.
Right, he's completely silent.
And it's through the immense power of the Buddha's blessings, radiating from his mind while in this state, that two very specific things happen.
Go ahead and lay those out.
First, Avalokiteshvara, who is the great bodhisattva embodying universal compassion, is moved to engage in the profound practice of the perfection of wisdom.
Uh-huh.
And second, Shariputra, who is a disciple known specifically for his vast analytical wisdom, is moved to ask a question about how to practice.
And this brings up a crucial dynamic in how Dharma is transmitted. The core of the Heart Sutra is essentially a dialogue between these two great disciples.
Facilitated by the Buddha's meditative presence, rather than a top-down lecture.
Right, exactly.
So why do you think that is? I mean, how does two disciples talking to each other, while the teacher sits in complete silence, reflect the way the Dharma is supposed to be transmitted and investigated by practitioners like us?
Well, it is a brilliant, living demonstration of dependent arising in action. The Buddha's silence isn't an absence of teaching.
What is it then?
It is actually the ultimate teaching of emptiness. It's the spaciousness that allows the discourse to manifest in the first place.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Right. By having Shariputra ask the question and Avalokiteshvara answer, the text models the process of inquiry. It shows us that wisdom isn't just something passively handed down from on high, like, you know, a downloaded file to a computer.
Yeah, it's not rote memorization.
No, it is generated through rigorous questioning, through dialogue, through an active searching mind. Shariputra represents the analytical intellect seeking the method.
And Avalokiteshvara.
He represents the realization of that method, totally grounded in universal compassion. The interaction between them actually is the teaching.
It's an active investigation. And speaking of the origins of that investigation, Geshe Dawa notes a very specific detail about the text itself.
Oh, the Sanskrit title.
Yes. In all the Tibetan translations of the Heart Sutra, the original Sanskrit title, Prajnaparamita Hridaya, is preserved at the very beginning, before translating the rest into Tibetan.
Yeah, he says this is done for 3 distinct reasons.
Right. First, to leave imprints of the Sanskrit language on the mind of the practitioner. Because tradition holds that all 1,000 Buddhas of this eon will teach in Sanskrit.
Which is fascinating cosmologically.
Second, to receive the blessings of the original language that the Indian masters spoke.
And the third?
To definitively prove the text's authentic Indian origin, ensuring it wasn't just some later fabrication made up in Tibet.
It grounds the practitioner in a verifiable, unbroken lineage. It's really important.
It is.
And once that authenticity is established, Geshe Dala takes a moment to define what we are actually aiming for here. He breaks down the term Prajnaparamita, or the perfection of wisdom, into 4 distinct categories.
This is vital because, you know, when we use the phrase perfection of wisdom in English, we usually just mean being very smart or like making good life choices.
Right, like having common sense. But in this context, it has highly specific technical meanings.
Let's go through those 4 because they really create a complete map. First is the scriptural perfection.
Okay.
This refers to the actual texts, the books, the written treatises that explain emptiness. So the Heart Sutra itself, literally printed on a page, is the scriptural perfection of wisdom. It is the map.
Got it. The physical text.
Then second is the path perfection. This is the subjective wisdom in the mind of the practitioner. It's this specific mental pathway that directly cognizes emptiness.
Right, the internal experience. And third is the natural perfection.
Which is what?
This is the objective reality itself. It is emptiness itself. The actual lack or emptiness of inherent existence in all phenomena.
Ah.
And finally, fourth is the resultant perfection. This refers to the final goal. The 2 Dharmakayas, or the truth body and nature body of a fully enlightened Buddha.
Okay, let me make sure I'm synthesizing that correctly.
Yeah.
Because those terms can definitely float away if we aren't careful.
Yeah, let's ground them.
Are we saying that to achieve the ultimate result, the resultant perfection of Buddhahood, you have to rely on the scriptural texts in order to develop the mental path inside your own consciousness, which then allows you to realize the natural reality of emptiness?
That is exactly the progression.
Wow.
You use the map, which is the scriptural, to walk the path to arrive at the territory, the natural, and attain the ultimate state, which is resultant.
A complete closed-loop system of transformation. That's beautiful.
It is. And having defined what this wisdom is, Geshe Dawa then moves to establish the stakes. Why should a practitioner dedicate their entire life, or frankly, lifetimes, to realizing this?
Yeah. What is the actual power of realizing emptiness?
He draws heavily on the Mahamudra teachings and Oryadeva's famous text, The 400 Stanzas, to make it clear that emptiness meditation isn't just a, you know, a nice supplementary practice.
Right, like an elective class.
Exactly. It is the absolute best, most necessary practice for achieving full enlightenment. He states that ignorance, specifically our innate ignorance of self-grasping, is the root of all samsara.
All our worldly problems.
Yeah, from minor daily anxieties to immense global conflicts. It all traces back to this root.
And here is a striking point he makes, referencing Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelug school. He says that even if you develop perfect bodhicitta, which is that infinite, unconditional compassion and the altruistic intention to achieve enlightenment solely for the sake of all sentient beings.
Which is incredible in its own right.
Yes, but he says that immense compassion alone cannot liberate you from samsara. Compassion, without the wisdom realizing emptiness, is incredibly noble, but it is effectively blind.
It cannot cut the root of suffering.
Exactly. It's like trying to chop down a massive poisonous tree by just trimming its leaves with love. You have to strike the root. And the root is ignorance. Only wisdom can cut it.
To really drive home how powerful this wisdom is at cutting that root, Geshe Dawa uses this incredible analogy. He talks about a burned seed.
Oh, I love this one.
He says that even a slight doubt tending toward the fact of emptiness has the power to uproot the causes of samsara. Think of an apple seed. You take that seed and you scorch it in a hot fire.
You just completely roast it.
Yeah. You can take that burned seed and plant it in the most fertile soil in the world. You can water it every day, give it perfect sunlight, but it will never, ever produce a sprout. Its internal potential to germinate has been fundamentally destroyed by the fire.
I want to linger on that burned seed analogy because it's profoundly encouraging. What he's saying is that the moment your mind genuinely begins to suspect that things do not exist inherently.
Even if you haven't fully realized it yet.
Exactly. Even if you don't have direct realization, but you have a strong, logically founded suspicion that this solid world might be an illusion, you have applied fire to the seed of your own ignorance.
That's it.
That seed of ignorance can no longer uncontrollably produce the sprouts of suffering and negative karma in the same solid, devastating way it used to. The structural integrity of your suffering has been compromised.
But, you know, Geshe Dawa also offers a very sobering warning alongside that encouragement.
What's the warning?
He notes that those with little merit never even get the chance to think about emptiness. It's a privilege to even encounter these concepts.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about how many beings in the universe, or even just humans on this planet right now, are entirely consumed by mere survival, or entirely consumed by material distraction. The opportunity to just sit and investigate the nature of reality is incredibly rare.
Which brings us to the specific philosophical lens we're using to do this investigation.
Yeah.
Geshe Dawa identifies this lens as the Prasangika Madhyamika view.
Right.
In the taxonomy of Buddhist philosophy, this is considered the middle way consequent school, and it is viewed as the final, ultimate, most refined philosophical view. He also refers to it as the Great Seal, or Mahamudra.
Now, when we hear the word Mahamudra, a lot of practitioners immediately think of advanced tantric practices.
Yeah, that's usually where the mind goes.
But Geshe Dawa makes a very clear distinction here between the sutric perspective of Mahamudra and the tantric perspective, doesn't he?
He does, and this is a distinction that often causes confusion. Sutrically, Mahamudra simply means the meditation on emptiness, exactly as it was taught by the great Indian master Nagarjuna. It relies on logical analysis and concentration.
Okay.
The objective reality you are looking for, emptiness itself, is the exact same in both the sutra path and the tantra path. The emptiness of a teacup is the same emptiness in both vehicles.
Right. The truth doesn't change.
Exactly. The difference lies entirely in the subjective side, the mind that is doing the cognizing.
Right. So what does the tantric approach look like, just for context, so listeners understand the difference?
Tantrically, Mahamudra requires much more complex conditions. It requires receiving empowerment from a qualified master, maintaining strict ethical commitments, engaging in what are called generation stage practices where you visualize yourself as a deity.
Wow. Okay.
And ultimately, completion stage practices, where you are actually manipulating the subtle wind energies of the physical body.
Oh, like working with the subtle nervous system.
Yes. You draw these energies into the central channel to forcefully generate a state of great bliss. And it is that extremely subtle mind of great bliss that is then used to cognize that exact same emptiness.
I see.
So Tantra uses profound physiological methods to access a deeper level of mind to realize the same truth. But the Heart Sutra operates firmly within the sutra vehicle, using logic and profound concentration.
That makes perfect sense. Tantra is using the subtle nervous system, effectively, as a hyper-advanced tool to realize what the sutra path realizes through rigorous conceptual deconstruction.
Exactly. But whether you are approaching it through sutra or tantra, the view itself, the Prasangika view, is described as being completely free of extremes.
Yeah, he lists 8 specific extremes that must be avoided.
Let me try to unpack these, because just listing them can sound like pure jargon.
Please do.
He says, there is no inherently existing arising and no inherently existing cessation. Meaning, things don't just pop into existence from their own independent side, and they don't vanish completely from their own side.
Correct. He also lists no eternalism and no nihilism. We naturally want to believe things last forever, eternalism, or that nothing matters and death is just a blank wall nihilism.
Yeah.
The middle way threads the needle between those two deeply ingrained fears.
Then he adds, no inherently existing coming, no going, no oneness, and no difference. We'll get into oneness and difference a lot when we talk about the meditation technique later.
For sure.
He also summarizes these into 4 primary extremes that the mind naturally falls into. The extreme of existence, the extreme of non-existence, the extreme of both, and the extreme of neither. The Prasangika view systematically negates all of these as inherent realities.
And given how profound and delicate this view is, how easy it is to misunderstand it and fall into one of those extremes, Geshe Dawa talks about the qualifications needed to engage with these teachings safely.
Who is the suitable disciple, right?
Exactly. Following the great master Chandrakirti, he says, the absolute ideal disciple will actually show physical signs when merely hearing teachings on emptiness.
Physical signs? Like what?
Their body hairs will stand on end and tears of joy will well up in their eyes just from hearing the word emptiness.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, their karmic affinity for this truth is so strong it triggers an actual physiological response.
That is beautiful. But Geshe Dawa is a very practical teacher. He looks around the room and acknowledges that such ideal disciples are exceedingly rare.
Yeah, most of us aren't weeping with joy when we read philosophy textbooks.
Right, so he lays out the 2 absolute minimum requirements to safely study this. First, you must not abandon the profound view due to a lack of interest.
Which is tempting when the logic gets dense.
It is. You can't just throw your hands up and say, this logic is too hard, it's just intellectual gymnastics, I'm just going to focus on being a nice person. You have to stick with it.
And second, and this is vastly more important, you must not fall into the trap of nihilism through your logical analysis.
Let's slow down here. What exactly does falling into nihilism mean in this specific context?
Nihilism here is the fatal misunderstanding that because things lack inherent independent existence, they don't exist at all.
Huh.
It's the mind saying, oh, if I am empty and my actions are empty, then nothing matters. Good and bad are illusions, so cause and effect or karma doesn't matter.
Which is a huge trap.
It's the most dangerous misunderstanding of emptiness. It leads to total ethical collapse. The realization of emptiness should actually make your respect for karma and cause and effect stronger, because you realize that everything is deeply interconnected and dependent.
I think it's important to highlight Geshe Dawa's own humility when discussing these qualifications. When discussing the qualifications of a teacher, he notes that teaching emptiness without personal experience actually breaks a root bodhisattva vow.
That's a heavy commitment.
It is. Yet, he humbly states to his students that he himself does not claim direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Instead, he says he possesses a doubt tending toward the fact, backed by decades of rigorous study.
That phrase again, doubt tending toward the fact.
Yeah, and I want to push back on that phrase a little bit, because in almost every worldly context, doubt is seen as a weakness. It's seen as a lack of faith or hesitation or insecurity.
Right. If a leader says they have doubt, we panic.
Exactly. We don't trust them.
Yeah.
But Geshe Dawa is elevating it. It sounds to me less like hesitation and more like a scientist who hasn't completed the final definitive experiment yet, but whose preliminary data points so strongly, so undeniably to a specific conclusion that their entire worldview shifts even before the final paper is published. Is that the kind of doubt Geshe Dawa means?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of epistemology in Buddhism, your scientist analogy is perfect. In the present Jika context, doubt tending toward the fact is not a wishy-washy hesitation. It is a highly advanced, logically derived cognitive state.
Fair.
When your preliminary data, your logical analysis, shows you that a solid, independent self cannot possibly exist, your mind enters a state of profound, fact-oriented suspicion. You suspect, heavily, that the innate way you perceive reality is a lie.
It's almost an awakening in itself.
It is the necessary stepping stone right before direct realization. It is a sign of immense intellectual honesty.
With that groundwork laid, the history established, and the stakes understood, we can finally turn to the absolute heart of the sutra's text. This is the famous four-line formulation that Avalokiteshvara speaks directly to Shariputra.
Gishadao calls this the passage with four profundities.
These four lines are perhaps the most chanted, most analyzed words in all of Mahayana Buddhism. Monks and lay people chant them daily across the world.
Let's walk through Geshe Dawa's precise unpacking of them. Line one, form is empty.
Geshe Dawa explains that this means form, meaning any physical object, like a table, a mountain, or your own body, does not exist from its own side. It doesn't have an independent, objective reality standing there in the universe waiting to be looked at.
Right.
It exists only through name and imputation by the mind.
But he gives a massive warning here, tying back to the danger of nihilism we just discussed. This does not mean form doesn't exist at all. This introduces the absolute backbone of Buddhist philosophy, the concept of the two truths.
Specifically, conventional truth.
Exactly. The form, the table, is there conventionally. It functions. You can put a cup of tea on it, but it is empty of ultimate, inherent, independent existence.
Right. If you chop the table into splinters, where did the table go? The table was just a label your mind applied to wood and nails arranged in a specific way.
Yeah.
Then we move to line two. Emptiness is form.
Geshe Dawa explains that the non-truly existing nature within that form, that very absence of inherent existence, is the emptiness.
This is a subtle point. He contrasts this heavily with lower Buddhist tenet schools.
How so?
Well, some lower philosophical schools believe that even if a table is mostly empty space and dependent parts, if you break it down far enough, there must be some tiny, indivisible, partless particle that truly exists from its own side, serving as the ultimate building block.
Oh, like a fundamental atom. Right. But the Prasangika view completely negates that. There are no ultimate building blocks. The emptiness of the form is its ultimate reality.
Line three, emptiness is no other than form. This means that emptiness and form share the exact same nature, but they have different names and are different entities conceptually.
Okay, that makes sense.
Form is the conventional truth. Its emptiness of inherent existence is the ultimate truth. They're two sides of the exact same coin. You can't have the emptiness of a table without the table.
And finally, line four. Form is no other than emptiness. This explains how the very object appearing to our eye consciousness right now, precisely because it is empty of inherent existence, proves that conventional truth and ultimate truth are of one nature.
They cannot be separated.
Right. The fact that the table changes, that it ages, that it relies on causes and conditions, proves it is empty. Its form is the proof of its emptiness.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I want to try an analogy to clarify these four lines for you, the listener, because the language of form is empty, emptiness is form, can feel like a Zen riddle or a paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely can. Let's hear it.
Let's think of an ocean wave. Line one, form is empty, translates to wave is water. The wave has no independent waveness separate from the water. It's not a permanent object moving across the ocean. It's just water momentarily taking a shape.
Okay.
Line two, emptiness is form, translates to water is wave. The water's nature is currently expressing itself entirely as that specific shape. You cannot point to a wave without pointing to water, and in that exact moment, the water is entirely expressing itself as that wave.
I follow.
They are conventionally different. One is a shape moving, one is liquid H2O,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately they're of one identical nature.
I think that analogy is highly effective for visualizing the concept, especially for understanding lines three and four, that they are no other than each other. But I am going to push back slightly.
Oh, okay. Why?
I want to rigorously tie it back to Geshe Dawa's definitions because analogies can become traps. The danger with the wave and water analogy is that water is still a physical substance. In the Prasangika view, the water, meaning the emptiness, isn't a mystical substance underlying the wave or the form. Emptiness is a mere negative. It is the sheer absence of the wave existing from its own side. It is a lack, not a substance.
Okay. That distinction is so sharp. It's not that there's a magical glowing substance called emptiness that builds the universe. Emptiness is just the absolute fact that the universe isn't solid.
Exactly.
Maybe a better analogy is a reflection in a mirror. The face in the mirror, the form, is completely empty of being a real flesh and blood face, which is the emptiness.
Yeah.
But you can't have the reflection without the emptiness of it being real.
The mirror analogy is much safer within the Prasenjika system. It perfectly highlights that conventional appearance and ultimate emptiness occur simultaneously in the exact same object.
Knowing that philosophy is vital, it is the scriptural perfection we talked about earlier. But Geshe Dawa's primary goal in these 1996 sessions is practical application.
How to actually do it.
Right. How does a beginner actually sit down on a meditation cushion, close their eyes, and meditate on an absence? This brings us to the core of his teaching, the four-point analysis.
This is where the rubber meets the road. We transition from profound theory into a precise, logical laboratory inside your own mind. The four-point analysis is a methodical way of investigating whether the self we feel so strongly actually exists the way it appears to us.
And it begins with point one. Ascertaining the object to be negated.
Geshe Dawa says this is the most crucial step of all. Without it, the rest is useless. He uses an archery analogy. You cannot shoot the arrow without clearly identifying the target.
Right. If you don't know what you're looking for, your logical analysis will just fly off into the dark.
Yeah, you'll end up meditating on nothing, or worse, you'll negate the wrong thing and fall into nihilism. To help us find the exact target, he distinguishes between three completely different levels of self.
Let's clearly define those three levels, because getting this wrong is the source of endless confusion in Buddhist practice. First, there is the self of realized beings. This is a highly advanced mind that still has the appearance of a self. They still say, I am walking, I am talking, but they completely non-conceptually know it is empty of inherent existence, just like knowing that reflection in the mirror is just a reflection.
Second, there is the merely labeled self. This is the valid, conventional self of ordinary beings like us.
Right.
It's the self that pays taxes, goes from life to life, functions in society, wakes up, eats breakfast, and sleeps. Geshe Dawa is incredibly clear. You do not negate this self. If you try to analyze this self out of existence, you fall into nihilism. You become completely paralyzed.
And then there's the third self, the innate self-grasping. This is the target. This is the ultimate villain of the piece. This is the specific object to be refuted.
How does Geshe Dawa define this innate self-grasping? Because it sounds very abstract.
He defines it as the self that appears to exist solidly, vividly, and completely independently within the collection of our aggregates, our body and mind. It feels like there is a me driving the meat suit of the body.
It appears to be there without depending on causes, without depending on physical conditions, and without depending on mere labeling. It just feels natively, inherently there.
It feels like the boss.
To help us actually feel this, to find the specific target so we can shoot it, Geshe Dawa recommends a very specific, almost uncomfortable psychological exercise.
The false accusation one.
Yes. He says, observe your mind when you are falsely accused of stealing. Imagine you are at work or with your family and someone points a finger directly in your face and publicly, aggressively accuses you of something terrible that you absolutely did not do.
Oh, that's infuriating, just to think about.
Notice the incredibly solid, vivid, outraged self that suddenly flares up inside your body, completely unable to tolerate the accusation. How dare you say that about me, Nee?
That incredibly solid, tight, outraged I.
That is the target.
It's a brilliant laboratory because strong, negative emotion strips away our relaxed intellectual veneer. I actually paused while reading the transcript and applied this false accusation scenario to myself. And it is a deeply visceral feeling.
Isn't it?
If I imagine someone accusing me of stealing, my heart races. My breath gets shallow. And that I that feels offended isn't an abstract philosophical concept. It feels incredibly localized. It feels like it's sitting right in the center of my chest, tight, or maybe hot behind my eyes.
It is a dense, heavy, almost metallic knot of meanness.
Yes. Why is strong negative emotion the absolute best laboratory for finding this innate self-grasping?
Because when we are relaxed, drinking a cup of tea, the innate self-grasping is subtle. It's humming quietly in the background, like the operating system of a computer.
You don't notice it because it's just running everything smoothly.
Exactly. But when the ego is threatened, when a false accusation attacks the validity of your existence or your moral character, that operating system goes into overdrive to protect itself.
The illusion solidifies to mount a defense.
The eye steps out of the shadows, puts on armor, and grabs a sword. And because it becomes so bright, so vivid, and so localized, like you said, in the chest or behind the eyes, it finally becomes a clear, stationary target for your logical arrows. You can finally see the ghost.
Okay, so once that inherently existent self flares up, once you have that tight knot in your chest and your crosshairs, what do? You don't just sit there feeling angry.
No, the practitioner must immediately trap it with logical analysis to see if it can actually withstand scrutiny. This moves us to point two of the analysis, establishing the logical possibilities.
And this point relies on formal logic, specifically the law of the excluded middle. Geshe Dawa states the premise with absolute clarity, so there is no wiggle room.
Let's hear it.
If this innate, solid, vivid self actually exists inherently, exactly as it appears to Rude, if that tight knot in your chest is the real you, it must exist in relation to your aggregates being your physical form, your feelings, your discrimination, your compositional factors, and your consciousness.
It has to have a relationship with the body and mind.
Exactly. And there are only two logical possibilities for that relationship. It must be either inherently one with your aggregates, or inherently separate, meaning many, from them. There is absolutely no third option.
It is either the exact same thing as your parts, or it is a different thing than your parts.
It's a perfect logical trap. If it's truly there, it has to be exactly the same thing as your body and mind, or it has to be something completely different. So point three is the first half of the investigation, free of being inherently one.
We look to see if the solid self and the aggregates are exactly the same thing, and Geshe Dawa unleashes a barrage of logical refutations here. He hits it from multiple angles.
Let's walk through his precise logic step by step. First, he looks at linguistics and how we instinctively speak. We naturally say my body or my mind.
Right.
This linguistic structure intrinsically implies a possessor, the self, and something possessed the body. If the self and the body were inherently one identical thing, saying my body would be completely redundant.
It would be like saying body, body.
Exactly. The possessor and the possessed would collapse into a single entity, which contradicts our own lived experience of feeling like we have a body.
He goes further with a really stark physical example about mortality. If the self and the physical body were truly one inherently identical thing, what happens at death? When the body dies, is placed in a fire, and becomes cremated ashes, the self would also have to become cremated ashes. If A equals B, whatever happens to A must happen to B.
And if the self becomes literal ashes, there is no continuum of consciousness to take rebirth.
Which would logically make the entire Buddhist practice of virtue and non-virtue completely pointless. If the self ceases entirely with the physical body, karma has no basis to ripen upon. Your actions would have no consequences after death.
He also uses a mathematical refutation. As we mentioned, Buddhism categorizes the human experience into five aggregates: form, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, consciousness. If the inherently existent self is identical to the aggregates, and there are five distinct aggregates, then there must be five distinct selves running around inside you. Or, conversely, since you vividly feel like one single unified self, you could only have one single aggregate. You couldn't have both a body and a mind. The math simply doesn't work.
And perhaps the most subtle refutation in point three relates specifically to consciousness. He argues that if the self were inherently one with the aggregate of consciousness, then everything experienced by the physical body should be experienced identically by the consciousness itself.
Wait, unpack that.
If the physical body is freezing cold or starving in the snow, the consciousness itself should physically freeze or starve in the exact same manner. But consciousness is formless. It is clear and knowing. It doesn't freeze and shatter like flesh does.
Therefore, the self, the consciousness, and the physical body cannot be inherently one thing.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm going to put on my skeptical studie hat for a moment here and push back, because this is where modern listeners might tune out.
Fair enough. Go ahead.
Geshe Dawa says that if the self were one with consciousness, consciousness should physically experience cold. But many modern people, especially operating in a secular scientific framework, do equate the self purely with the mind or the brain.
A materialist view.
Yeah. Modern materialist would say, look, I am not my hand. If I lose my hand in an accident, I am still 100% me. I am my brain, my neural network, my consciousness. How does Geshe Dawa's logic dismantle the idea that I am just my consciousness?
This raises an important question, and it's exactly the view of what Buddhism calls the transitory collection view. It's the innate tendency of the ego to grasp at one specific aggregate, usually the stream of consciousness or the intellect, and forcefully label it the absolute permanent I.
Right.
Geshe Dawa's logic dismantles this by dragging us back to the target we identified in point one. We have to be honest about what we are actually feeling.
Right, the false accusation.
Exactly. When you are falsely accused, the I that flares up in outrage doesn't just feel like a formless floating consciousness or a firing neural net. It feels inextricably bound to the chest, to the heat in the face, to the physical stance you take when you defend yourself. You feel a bodily threat.
That's very true.
Furthermore, if the self were purely the consciousness, then consider what happens when you fall into deep, dreamless sleep. The gross consciousness absorbs. The thoughts stop. Where does the self go?
Oh, wow.
If you are just your brain, your self is constantly changing every millisecond as synapses fire and neurotransmitters wash in and out. But be honest, the innate self-grasping doesn't feel like a constantly changing electrical storm. It feels permanent. It feels unitary.
It feels like the you looking out of your eyes today is the exact same you that looked out of your eyes when you were 7 years old.
The modern scientific view that I am my brain is just another form of conventional imputation. It is not the inherent, unchanging, boss-like self that our deepest ignorance grasps at.
That is a brilliant dismantling. The self we instinctively feel is static, solid, and permanent, but the consciousness is a rushing, changing river. They cannot be the exact same thing.
So, if the self is not inherently one with the aggregates, we move to point four, free of being inherently many, or completely separate.
Is the self hiding somewhere else, pulling the strings from behind a curtain, completely independent of the body and mind?
And Geshe Dawa walks through the logical refutations for this possibility just as rigorously. He says, if the self were completely separate from the aggregates, you should be able to conceptually or physically remove all the aggregates one by one.
Okay.
You take away the physical form, you take away the feelings of pleasure and pain, you take away the discrimination, the mental factors, and the consciousness itself. If the self is truly separate, you should still be left with a completely intact, findable self hovering there.
He uses a really helpful analogy here. It would be like a farmer removing animals from a pen one by one. You take out the sheep, you take out the pigs, and you can still point to the one cow that remains.
Because the cow is separate from the sheep.
Exactly. But if you take away a person's physical body and completely remove all their mental functions, you cannot point to a self that remains. It is impossible to even conceive of a self without referencing a body or a mind.
He adds another layer to this. If the self were inherently separate, it would have to have its own distinct characteristics completely independent of the body's characteristics.
Meaning
the physical body goes through birth, it ages, it gets sick, and it dies. But this completely separate self would logically be immune to those physical realities. Yet how do we speak?
We say, I am sick, or I am growing old, or I was born.
Right. We instinctively appropriate the body's physical characteristics as our own. We don't feel separate from the sickness.
Finally, he points to karma again. If the self were a completely separate entity, the karma performed by the physical body or the speech, say, the body steals something or the mouth tells a lie, wouldn't logically be experienced by this completely disconnected separate self.
The causal link between action and experience would be totally severed.
So let's look at what has happened. We have completely exhausted the logic. The vivid, solid, outraged self we felt when we were falsely accused cannot be found to be one with the body and mind.
It cannot be found separate from the body and mind.
And because of the law of the excluded middle, there is no third option.
The trap snaps shut. The practitioner reaches a profound, mathematically undeniable conclusion. That solid, independent self simply does not exist. It is a phantom. It was a projection the entire time.
Now, conceptually understanding that is one thing. But what does the mind do in that exact, precise moment of realization on the cushion?
This leads us directly to the meditation experience itself. When the logic completely exhausts the possibility of an inherent self and the mind truly accepts this, Geshe Dawa says the mind drops into a state of space-like concentration.
Let's describe this clearly, because he issues a very strict warning to practitioners here. He describes the result of this analysis as a clear, empty appearance, like looking up into a vast, cloudless autumn sky that is entirely free of obstruction. You looked for the solid, tight knot in your chest, you completely failed to find it, and what is left is the profound, spacious absence of that fabrication.
And the warning is absolutely vital, especially for modern mindfulness practitioners. Geshe Dawa emphasizes forcefully that this space-like concentration is not simply making the mind blank.
Right. It is not just doing breathing meditation, Shamatha, until your thoughts quiet down, your heart rate drops, and you feel a peaceful, fuzzy emptiness in your head.
True emptiness meditation requires the prior, active, forceful, logical negation of a specific object. You have to hunt the innate self, corner it, realize it isn't there, and then rest your mind in that specific absence.
A blank mind is just a lack of active thought. It's a state of temporary withdrawal. Space-like concentration is the active presence of wisdom, realizing a fundamental absence.
It is vipassana, penetrating insight. If you just blank your mind, you might become very relaxed, but you haven't scorched the seed of ignorance.
That is such a crucial distinction. Peacefulness is not emptiness. You can be completely peaceful while still fundamentally believing you inherently exist.
Exactly.
Okay, so this space-like meditation is the formal sitting at practice. You're on the cushion, absorbed in the absence, but eventually your knees hurt and the bell rings. What happens when you stand up?
Geshe Dawa talks about illusion-like meditation, which is the post-meditation experience of moving through the world.
Yes. When the practitioner gets off the cushion and walks out the door, phenomena, trees, cars, people, your own physical body still appear to your senses. They don't turn invisible.
Right.
You don't walk into walls.
No. But because of the profound realization you just had on the cushion, they are known to be like illusions.
Like illusions, not literal illusions.
Exactly. They appear one way. They still look solid, permanent, and inherent to your visual cortex. But your mind deeply knows they exist another way. Empty, dependent, and fleeting.
You are sitting in the audience of the magic show, watching the magician saw the lady in half. It looks real, but you know how the trick is done, so you don't panic. You engage with the world, but the desperate, grasping attachment to it is gone.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Geshe Dawa explains why doing this analytical meditation alone, just sitting in an isolated cave, getting better and better at seeing the illusion, is actually not enough to reach full enlightenment.
Yes. If we look at the entire Mahayana path, Geshe Dawa introduces the absolute necessity of the two wings. Realizing emptiness requires a massive collection of supportive conditions. It is not just a sterile intellectual puzzle you solve in a vacuum.
To give your mind the sheer power to sustain that realization, you must purely maintain the practice of morality. You must engage the world. You must practice radical generosity, immense patience when harmed, and overwhelming compassion.
He calls these the collection of merit, the compassion side, and the collection of wisdom, the emptiness side.
Mm-hmm.
You're the two wings of a bird. A bird with only the wing of wisdom, knowing everything is empty but lacking love, cannot fly to enlightenment. A bird with only the wing of merit, doing good deeds constantly, but still grasping at a solid self, cannot fly either. You need both to reach Buddhahood.
And he discusses a fascinating practical difference in how this is applied between different vehicles of Buddhism. For Hinayana followers, whose primary noble goal is their own personal liberation from suffering, once they realize emptiness, they might stay in deep, space-like meditative absorption for years, resting in that profound peace.
Wow.
But for Mahayana followers, whose goal is the liberation of all sentient beings, they set a defined, limited period for their space-like meditation. Once that period is over, they deliberately arise from the cushion. They actively work in the illusion-like world to benefit others.
To stay in peaceful meditation indefinitely while others suffer would be a complete failure of their bodhicitta, their compassion. I want to ask about the actual mechanics of being on the cushion, doing this analysis. Because Geshe Dawa gives a fascinating piece of psychological advice. He says you have to analyze with one part of your mind while simultaneously watching with another part.
The analogy of the two friends.
Yes. He compares it to two friends walking down a dangerous, narrow path. One friend's job is to carefully watch the path ahead for obstacles, and the other friend's job is to keep an eye on their companion to make sure they haven't fallen behind or gotten hurt.
Right.
Why this dual awareness? Why does he warn that analyzing too forcefully causes the innate self to hide?
It is a delicate psychological balancing act. Think about what we're doing. We are hunting the ego. If your analytical mind attacks the self too aggressively, with too much intense intellectual aggression and tight focus, the mind gets agitated. The subtle innate feeling of the I, that knot in the chest, realizes it's under threat and it simply retreats into the subconscious. It hides. The emotional temperature drops, and you end up just analyzing an abstract philosophical concept instead of a visceral feeling. You lose the target.
It's like trying to observe a shy animal in the wild. If you stomp through the brush, swinging a machete of logic, the animal runs away. You have to sit perfectly still, and let it appear naturally.
Precisely. The watcher part of the mind ensures that the visceral feeling of the self remains vivid and present, gently holding it in the light, while the analyzer part of the mind gently but firmly dissects its logic. It requires immense subtlety, not brute intellectual force.
To round out this incredible teaching, Geshe Dawa maps this entire journey of the practitioner, from the first moment of study to ultimate enlightenment, onto the vast progressive stages of a bodhisattva's career. He maps the Heart Sutra directly to the five paths.
Let's trace that map because it shows the immense scope of the text. The first is the path of accumulation. In the context of the Heart Sutra, this is the stage of the beginner.
This is where you are actively engaged in the four-point analysis we just discussed. You are accumulating merit and analyzing emptiness through the wisdom that arises from hearing teachings, reading texts, and contemplating them. You are building the foundation.
Next is the path of preparation. Geshe Dawa correlates this to the sutra's line, "Form is no other than emptiness." Here, the practitioner is deeply practicing through a union of both conceptual analysis and stabilizing meditation. The realization is getting closer. The mind is literally warming up to the direct truth.
Then comes the profound shift, the path of seeing. This aligns with the sutra's passages that begin, "In emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination."
This is the explosive moment of direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness. The conceptual scaffolding of the four-point analysis completely falls away. You don't need logic anymore.
The practitioner sees reality nakedly, directly perceiving the absence of inherent existence. It is a permanent shift in consciousness.
After that is the path of meditation.
If you've already seen it directly, what is left to meditate on?
Geshe Dawa explains this is the long, arduous process of deepening and familiarizing yourself with that direct realization. You are burning away the deepest, most subtle, habitual cognitive obscurations that have been ingrained for lifetimes.
Which finally leads to the fifth path, the path of no more learning. This is the resultant stage. This is full Buddhahood, the attainment of the two Dharmakayas, possessing infinite wisdom and infinite compassion to benefit all beings.
And Geshe Dawa notes a beautiful piece of skillful means in the sutra structure right at the end. When Avalokiteshvara answers Shariputra's initial question, the answer is actually given in two parts.
Right.
The expansive logical explanation we've been discussing, the form is empty, the analysis is the progressive path for those of us who need to go step by step. But at the very end of the sutra, there is the famous mantra section. Exactly. Geshe Dawa explains this mantra isn't just a nice song to end on. It is actually the entire teaching compressed for practitioners of the absolute sharpest intelligence who can traverse the five paths swiftly through the sheer power of the mantra.
It ensures that the teaching is perfectly accessible to every single level of mind present in that vast assembly of Vulture Peak and to us listening today.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? How do we synthesize Geshe Dawa's precise, immense practice instructions into something you can carry with you today, maybe onto a meditation cushion tonight? Let's recap the vital practice points.
Go for it.
First, remember the archery analogy. Identify the target before shooting the arrow. Do not sit down and just meditate on a blank, peaceful mind. Actively hunt for the innate self-grasping.
Second, use the laboratory of your own difficult emotions. Observe yourself when falsely accused, or when someone cuts you off in traffic, or when your pride is wounded. Find that solid, vivid, tight eye that flares up in defense. That is the illusion you must dissect.
Third, and this is so empowering for an independent practitioner, trust your own analytical experience over simply hearing others' words. Geshe Dawa says that mere intellectual understanding can easily be swayed.
Yeah, if someone comes along with a clever philosophical argument tomorrow, you might change your mind.
Exactly. But if you have rigorously dissected your own self-grasping on the cushion, and you have tasted that space-like clear appearance of emptiness, no one can talk you out of your own direct lived experience.
And finally, maintain both wings. Cultivate relentless daily compassion and merit alongside this razor-sharp analytical wisdom. One without the other will not fly.
We started this deep dive talking about waking up from a dream. How the sheer terrifying solidity of the dream world completely vanishes when you open your eyes. The Heart Sutra, as taught by masters like Geshe Dawa, is the ultimate alarm clock.
It really is.
It is telling us that the solid limitations we feel, our deep anxieties, our fixed identities, our seemingly insurmountable obstacles, are constructed of the exact same empty, imputable stuff as that dream.
And I want to leave you with the final thought, addressing you directly. Reflect back on the seed analogy we discussed earlier. Geshe Dawa said a burned seed cannot sprout. But let's look at the seed from the perspective of emptiness itself. If a seed existed inherently, exactly as it appears, if it existed from its own side, solidly and permanently, it could never, ever change. It would remain a hard little seed forever. A sprout could never break through the hull. A towering tree could never grow.
Wow.
It is precisely because the seed is empty of inherent existence that it has the capacity to interact with water, soil, and sunlight. It is emptiness that allows it to change, to transform, to grow into something magnificent.
That is beautiful. Emptiness isn't a dark void.
No, it is the exact opposite of a void. Emptiness is the very mechanism of your infinite potential. Because you do not inherently exist as a fixed, permanent, damaged, or limited self, you have the absolute capacity to learn, to grow, to develop bodhicitta, and eventually to achieve full enlightenment. The lack of solidity in your life is your ultimate freedom.
So ask yourself, what current, seemingly solid limitation in your life, what heavy narrative you carry about who you are and what you cannot do, might actually just be an empty, imputable form, completely waiting and ready to transform.